It is a State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now we dig into sheriffs on the ballot and running unopposed. Every midterm, counties elect a new sheriff, and this election, most were uncontested races. The nonprofit Criminal Justice Investigative Newsroom, the Marshall Project, has looked into the power of sheriffs and what they campaign on. Join in on the role of elective sheriffs in law enforcement. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Maurice Chama is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. He's been writing about sheriffs and their political positions. Maurice, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, some baseline thoughts here. Our country has, 3,000 county sheriffs. They are elected officials who run for office in 46 states, including here in Wisconsin. How powerful is a sheriff's influence?
They're very powerful. And part of why I got into this reporting was because I had always sort of heard about sheriffs. I'd interacted with them during my reporting. But it wasn't until I sort of started reading and getting into it that I realized just how much they do. I mean, in almost every county, they run a jail. So they're affecting the lives of people who are coming in and out of that jail when they're under arrest. But for many communities, especially more rural areas, they are functionally the police chief. They're overseeing all the patrolling that goes on in the county. And in some places, they're carrying out evictions. They're doing security at courthouses and airports and other institutions. And then they are, as elected officials, have individual power in their counties, and then they work together in state sheriff associations and can be quite powerful as lobbyists at state legislatures and even in Congress.
So some people might argue, say, look, an elected official is more accountable to the voters and to the public than an appointed official would be. How does that sit with your reporting?
What we found is that that's not always the case, in the sense that because these are such low information races, because many people, can't name their local sheriff and just, check a box next to an R or a D or the incumbent name they vaguely recognize, you end up having sheriffs who stay in power for many years, sometimes even decades. And in some cases, they'll even functionally appoint their successor. So you saw certain races in Wisconsin, in Wisconsin and elsewhere around the country, where one of the candidates had an incumbent advantage, not because they had really been in power that long, but because a prior sheriff appointed them, maybe a year before the election, 2 years before. And then they were on the ballot. And I say appointed them. Technically, they asked the governor to do that. But the governor, from my understanding, often relies on the recommendation of the prior sheriff. So you sometimes have these almost like dynastic lines of sheriffs who have just appointed their successors. And because voters don't always really look that closely into who they're voting for or just rely on party affiliation, you don't get quite the accountability that one might expect from elections.
How competitive are sheriff races? What did you find?
What I found is that they're generally not that competitive because of these issues that I've been describing, but that is starting to change. You're starting to see more battles. Not a ton of money flows into these races, but you are starting to see challengers, especially to sheriffs who have been in power for a very long time, and in counties where there's been a great deal of either media scrutiny or kind of grassroots awareness of problems, whether that's deaths in the local county jail or a level of immigration enforcement that's extremely aggressive and doesn't sort of comport with the community's values. You're starting to see cases around the country where sheriffs are sort of challenging these longtime incumbents and occasionally winning.
We're talking about the power and influence of sheriffs here in Wisconsin and around the nation. Maurice Chama is an author and staff writer at the Marshall Project. You can join in on sheriff races, what you've seen in your community. 800-642-1234. Maurice, you've examined this small wave of progressive sheriffs emerging, being elected across the country. What are the political beliefs of progressive sheriffs?
This is an interesting group of people that have come onto the scene. So What it means to be a progressive sheriff is still very much in the air, but you're seeing a small wave of sheriffs across the country. Calvin Barrett in Dane County, you know, strikes me as one of them, who take progressive positions on a variety of issues. One of those is to make their jails more rehabilitative, to kind of give people mental health counseling and substance abuse counseling sort of in place of what might exist at other jails, you know, which are basically nothing and sometimes very, you know, dire conditions that make mental illness and substance abuse worse. You see a lot of progressive sheriffs, including Barrett, saying that they are not going to enforce new bans on abortion that are getting passed around the country, that they are sort of not in the business of going after people seeking abortions or medical providers. And that it strikes me as, you could argue basically that that's a progressive position. In San Antonio, Texas, there's a sheriff who pledged to investigate the flights that were organized by Ron DeSantis's administration in Florida, you know, sending migrants to Martha's Vineyard. And so you have sheriffs kind of setting themselves up as the foil of a prominent, you know, conservative, which you could say is kind of puts them in the progressive category. So, you know, this is sort of all over the map what exactly it means to be a progressive, but you're starting to see these sheriffs self-identify that way and others identify them that way.
In the evolution of the Black Lives Matter protests, we heard the calls to defund the police. And I'm wondering, how does that sit with progressive sheriffs and the more traditional sheriffs?
It's a good question. So, you know, I worked on this survey with a pair of political scientists, and we got responses from roughly 500 sheriffs across the country out of the 3,000. And overall, sheriffs were extremely dismissive of those protests in 2020. They saw, you know, deaths of Black Americans at the hands of police as isolated incidents, and that these protests were motivated by bias, longstanding bias against law enforcement, as opposed to, you know, a real genuine desire for accountability. Now, as we get into, you know, 2022 and the kind of backlash to the defund the police movement, you do see a lot of sheriffs who say, well, actually, no, we need more funding. If we're going to make a jail, for example, that really takes into account people's mental health issues or provides real substance abuse or job counseling or other kinds of programs to really help people get back on their feet, that's going to cost money. And so, you know, progressive sheriffs aren't necessarily saying defund us, right? You're seeing basically a push for using that money in a different way.
Maurice Chama is a staff writer at the Marshall Project, the nonprofit news organization focusing on criminal justice issues, as we explore the sheriff's position as an elected office voted on by the people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we take a closer look at the elected office of sheriff. Races for sheriff across Wisconsin's 72 counties occur every 4 years. And across the nation, the Marshall Project, the nonprofit newsroom focused on justice issues, they've been looking into the hundreds of sheriffs that were on the November ballot. Join in, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Marshall Project staff writer Maurice Chama stays with us. Let's take a call now. Pete is with us in La Crosse. Hi, Pete. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, Kate, Maurice. So we're all familiar with the system of checks and balances on the president, Congress, and the judicial. What is the typical system of checks and balances on our local government, specifically on the office of sheriff?
Pete, thank you. Maurice?
Yeah, thanks for that. It's extremely limited. And that's a one reason I think that we got fascinated with sheriffs and their power and how little understood it was, is that there aren't a lot of checks and balances. So sheriffs themselves will basically say the checks and balances are elections, that voters can kick me out if they think I'm doing a bad job. Of course, we've seen many times that sheriffs who have done bad things. There was a case this year in South Carolina where a sheriff had made racist remarks and resigned and then got elected with his incumbency advantage 2 weeks later. So elections don't always provide, especially good checks and balances. Usually, I mean, it varies a little bit by state, but usually county commissioners are approving the budget for a sheriff. But often those county commissioners, each of them, represents one pocket of the county, and the sheriff represents the whole county. So the sheriff often has a kind of political power that allows them to kind of get what they want from the county commissioners. And I have not seen a lot of cases where county commissioners can hold sheriffs accountable by denying them funding. Of course, if they do that, the sheriff can always say, well, then they're making, our job harder and crime is going to go haywire. So overall, there's very few checks and balances on sheriffs. A few counties, a few states have citizen review boards and commissions that can exercise some oversight, but it remains extremely limited.
I want to look at the power of sheriffs in endorsements because here in Wisconsin, we were in a battleground state, inundated by ads in the midterms. And in particular, there were three Wisconsin County sheriffs who appeared in a campaign ad for Republican candidate Tim Michaels in the governor's race. And the ad features the Washington County Sheriff, the Dodge County Sheriff, and the Waukesha County Sheriff.
No one expects to see me at their doorstep.
But it's happening more because of Tony Evers.
Evers released hundreds of violent criminals from prison.
Some of the worst offenders in Wisconsin history.
Some struck again.
And others will.
And so Tim Michaels lost the race for governor, but how much weight do sheriff endorsements have in elections?
It's hard to know because we, can't measure their effect, with specificity. But that said, sheriffs, when people hear the word sheriff, they imagine law and order. They imagine maybe a cowboy hat and a gun on their hip and somebody who's really trying to keep the community safe. This goes back to, John Wayne movies, 50 years ago. And sheriffs, you often see them endorsing candidates when crime is on the ballot because they are the law enforcement official who voters associate with fighting crime. And so I think it can be a really potent endorsement. A more famous example a few years ago was Milwaukee, Sheriff David Clark became a pretty prominent surrogate for Donald Trump when he was on the campaign trail. To the point that I remember Clark was even considered for, there was talk of him being considered for a cabinet position. So you are increasingly seeing sheriffs at the statewide level kind of voicing their opinions in these endorsements. And part of that is that it may help the candidates, but I also wonder the extent to which it's helping these sheriffs kind of build statewide or even national brands.
You mentioned the image of a sheriff, the cowboy hat, the gun on hip. And I also see in my head white male in their 50s, perhaps 60s. And that's not off because according to their Reflective Democracy campaign, their research, about 90% of the nation's sheriffs are white men. What do you make of that statistic in reflecting on the role of sheriffs as elected officials?
It's a great question. I mean, the Reflective Democracy campaign, as a kind of progressive group, sees a connection between the fact that sheriffs are currently, vastly overrepresented among white men and the history of sheriffs, which included real clear efforts, 50, 100 years ago to maintain white supremacy, frankly, in many communities. I mean, sheriffs were often very involved in lynchings of Black Americans. They were involved in fighting civil rights, movements and efforts by the federal government to desegregate schools. You go back further, and sheriffs were the ones running the jails where Black Americans were essentially continuing slave labor after, being arrested for minor crimes. So the office of the sheriff has this really fraught history, and there hasn't really been a reckoning over it. Today, most sheriffs are white and male and in their 50s. And one thing that tends to align with is conservatism. And one thing our survey found is that sheriffs are extraordinarily conservative. I mean, you might not be surprised to hear that they tend to be conservative, but the number of sheriffs who described themselves as liberal or on the left was just about 1%. 28% said moderate or middle of the road, and the rest, you know, around 70% said conservative or very conservative. And as a result, you know, they tend to take conservative positions on a lot of things, and that's and they're often more conservative, and this is important, than the constituents in their own communities, right? So a community might say, we don't want to be in the business of, for example, you know, aggressively seeking out and arresting and detaining undocumented people, but they'll have a sheriff in that county who is working in lockstep through a federal program. It's called the 287G program, to essentially be local immigration enforcement and work with ICE to detain and deport people. So often you'll see a gap between what members of a community think and what their sheriff thinks, and because these are such low information races and people don't know who their sheriff is, you can see a really big gap between the community's values and the sheriff's policy decisions.
Maurice Chamaz, a staff writer at the Marshall Project, been writing and reporting on the influence of sheriffs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Michael in Madison. Michael, hi, go ahead.
Hi there. So I went to a, when I was a kid, I always wanted to be in policing. And so I went to a college for that. And what I found when I was there was that I think that there was one non-white male in my entire progress from undergraduate to graduating to finding a job. And I think if we need to, and in order to get to upper echelons in policing, you need to have those degrees. So what's preventing or what's incentivizing white males to go into that field, and what's disincentivizing non-white males to go into that field, talking Blacks, Hispanics, women of all colors? What do we got to do to get them involved?
The pipeline. Michael, thank you. Maurice.
It's a good question. And I have seen instances around the country where there is an effort. So there are a few Black sheriffs and women sheriffs and Latino sheriffs. And some of the ones that I've talked to have said that they are actively trying to recruit more, you know, Black and Latino youth to go into the policing profession. You see police chiefs kind of make a similar pitch. And honestly, I think a lot of the problem there has to do with a kind of deeper distrust of the police in those communities, a deeper sense that the police have kind of not been on their side historically. And so you're seeing, you know, I think the more that you have Black and Latino sheriffs kind of put themselves out there as a kind of model of what it would look like to have that identity and do that profession, they are trying to kind of motivate young people to go into it. One thing I know sometimes they're doing is going to the military and trying to recruit specifically people coming out of the military who might be Black or Latino to go in, you know, right into a sheriff's office, kind of smooth the path to employment for them. So I think getting them into the profession and getting them into those degree programs has to do with kind of meeting them where they are and looking for, you know, what are other pockets, whether it's the military or somewhere else where you're going to find a pool of people who are maybe willing and interested in going down that road.
We have less than a minute left, but what did your survey show about views on gun legislation?
Sheriffs are tremendously pro-gun. A generation ago, this wasn't the case. You know, a generation ago, law enforcement often said, we want to be the only people with firearms. But today, most sheriffs are very anti-gun control and often refuse in their communities to enforce the red flag laws and other laws that state legislatures pass. And this goes to a larger subject that we can talk about another time of so-called constitutional sheriffs, who basically believe that their authority is greater than the state or federal government. And on guns and many other issues, they are kind of bucking whatever it is that the state legislature is trying to do.
Maurice, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maurice Sciama is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. You can find links to a few of his recent articles about sheriffs on our program page at WPR.org/mornings. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine what school districts sought to pass in the midterms through referendums. According to the State Department of Public Instruction, there were 166 school district referendum questions of all types that went before voters this year. The Wisconsin Association of School Boards says this is the highest number since 2000. From facility upgrades to money to keep and attract staff, join in on what your district asked for, how you felt about it. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jill Underley is State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Superintendent Underley, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much, Kate. I was looking forward to talking with you all this morning.
Well, yes, you know, Wisconsin districts, they held a total of 81 referendums on Tuesday. According to your DPI reports platform, 64 passed. Why are schools relying on these to fund operations and infrastructure?
Well, I think it's twofold. Honestly, our local communities support their public schools. I think that's really evident by the number of referendums that are passed throughout the state. But I also think it's very clear that voters want to make sure that, you know, our kids, our students, they're getting what they need. And they made it very clear that they know that what's best for our kids is what's best for our state. So they strongly support our public schools, but they're also rejecting, you know, the divisive and the hateful rhetoric that's kind of coming out of places.
You know, had all the referendums passed, that would have totaled more than $2 billion. Why are districts in need of billions of dollars?
Yeah, so the reason that we have to pass so many referendums is because our state funding for our public schools hasn't really kept up with anything. Since 1993, we've had revenue caps on our school districts. And things go up in price, you know, personnel, certainly, that's our majority of school districts. That's their expenditure. The majority of their budget is personnel. But also you look at facility upgrades, you look at programs, you look at just being able to provide a high quality public education. I mean, it costs money. And when the state isn't providing their share, or their, what they would promise our school districts normally, the local communities have to make up for it. And what we're seeing, you know, is that the communities want to fund our public schools. And that's where we run into issues, because some communities are able to pass these referendums and others aren't. And so our schools become more unequal.
Is this typical, though, that you see so many referendum to increase staff salaries and benefits, to retain and attract educators? I mean, I'm reading directly from referendum. Provide competitive inflationary increases for all staff. Keep up with inflationary costs. Is it typical for referendums to target pay like this?
Yeah, it is now. So back before, let's say, 1993, the state used to be able to keep up, they promised 2/3 funding, mm-hmm. right, to our school districts. And so 1/3 of our school funding came from local taxpayers. But as that percentage of what the state promised has dwindled, I mean, there's a lot of areas, like, for example, how much the state reimburses our school districts for special education costs, for example. as that percentage has declined, the share that our local school districts have had, our taxpayers have had to pay, has gone up. And so, yes, staff has to, you know, we have to pay staff. And you think about wages, utilities, programming, all these transportation costs, all of that goes up, and it has exceeded the amount that the state has provided to our schools. And so in order to keep those programs going, or to provide, you know, safe and secure buildings, or to keep a program from being cut, or to pay teachers, our school districts have to make up that shortfall. And so they do so through referendum.
17 school referendums totaling almost $365 million, they failed. How significant is that lack of requested additional funds? What can that mean?
So when school districts, you know, have these questions, they try to do a lot of research in the community to see what's going to pass.
Mm-hmm.
And so in those cases, when something doesn't pass, usually the school district will do a little bit of soul searching, you know, their school board members, the community, to figure out why not, right? Sometimes if it's a school consolidation where they want to build a new building, the community, there might be some kind of disconnect. So they need to do a little bit of more research to figure out, you know, what the community would support. But if it's something like operational costs, that's where it's very, very troubling. Because when you look at the size of, for, you know, some of these non-recurring operational referendums, there's sometimes a third, and sometimes a little bit more, of a school district's annual operating budget. And so what they have to do is they have to rely on, they have what they call a fund balance, or they have to cut. And they generally have a year or two to do that before they are completely out of funding. And so that's where, you know, it gets really concerning when you see these large amounts that are for operational costs that fail, because in that case, the school district is really, really struggling and in trouble.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the high number of school referendums that were held last week, and we have State School Superintendent Jill Underlie. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Superintendent Underlie, you know, Wisconsin schools had access to billions of dollars of federal pandemic relief funding. With this boost in federal funding, why are schools still struggling to make ends meet?
So so what had happened was, when we got the federal funding, at the time that that budget was passed in the state, so this is the 2021-23 budget, the legislature didn't provide any additional funding to schools, because they said, you know, we're not going to give you, and sometimes it's around 2% is generally what we were hoping for. A lot of years it's been less than that. But
yeah,
they didn't give us the, you know, the funding amount. And so
I will place you on hold. And
I'm sorry, we're getting a little bit of, Superintendent Underlie, go ahead.
Sorry, it's, so let me go back to that train of thought.
Yeah.
So the federal government gave us money, and our legislature said, we're not going to give you schools a increase because you're getting this federal dollars. And so the federal dollars expire, and they expire at the end of this next school year. And so therefore, our school districts haven't been getting funding the past couple years. So we're already a little bit behind when you think of, like, just a simple inflationary increase, which we weren't getting anyway, by the way. So the money runs out in 2024. And so what you're hearing in the newspapers, or by your school boards, your school district superintendents, is we're going to hit this funding cliff because the federal money runs out and the state didn't give us any increase. And so we're kind of relying on funding from, like, 2019 almost, when you think about it, and what we were given back then.
A lot has changed since 2019.
Absolutely.
The world has changed.
Absolutely.
Jill Underlie, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, as we dig into school referendums, get her takeaways on what districts are facing after voters weighed in. Join in on how you felt about school referendums on your ballot. What stood out to you in the things districts asked for? 800-642-1234. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the midterm elections, voters weighed in on 81 school district referendums. That's from the State Department of Public Instruction's Referenda Reports platform. And in all, residents were asked to approve about $2 billion in additional funds. Join in on the school district requests, referendums that failed, and why. 800-642-1234. We have State Education Chief Jill Underly, who stays with us. Let's bring in Christine now in Eau Claire. Hi, Christine. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just think it's important for Jill to say that it's, when she talks about the state not funding it, it's really the Republicans in the Assembly and in the Senate. Former DPI Superintendent Tony Evers would happily fund the schools, and especially after he just won re-election. Again, I think it's important to state that the Republicans in the Senate and the Assembly won't fund the schools. So,
Christine, thank you, Superintendent Underly. What about the legislature here? Doesn't have a supermajority, but more Republicans elected in the midterms.
Yeah, I mean, so it's really one of those things. So my office is nonpartisan, and Christine makes a great point, obviously. It's there's a contingency in the legislature, particularly when you look at the Joint Finance Committee, that, you know, takes these budget items that are for schools and, you know, messes around with them a bit, you know, like certainly, you know, zeros them out or says we're not going to fund these programs, doesn't give us an inflationary increase. I mean, we need a predictable funding system for our schools so they don't have to go to referendum. You look at all these different bucket items that we have, other states, they, you know, it's one big package. Here's how much our schools need. And then they decide, are they going to increase it or, you know, keep it what it was before. But in Wisconsin, it's really easy to just knock off, you know, certain budget items one by one. And that's tough, right? Because, you know, last Tuesday showed us that Wisconsin communities overwhelmingly support their public schools and that they recognize the need for our schools to have additional funding. Hence, they pass these referendums. But they shouldn't have to, because our legislature, and, you know, Christine's right, you know, it's these certain people within the legislature who have this power, they should be doing their job and fund our schools. And I mean, we need to get to a system in school funding where therefore it will stop forcing our schools to go to referendum and have to ask communities for support, because it is the state's responsibility.
Well, let's bring in some tape here. After the election Tuesday, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said he sees room for compromise on education. Let's take a listen.
I would say you can find some middle ground. I want to have, and I wanted to have, universal school choice, a massive expansion of options for parents. Tony Evers wants more money for public schools. Well, we probably could find a way to say we'll give more money to all schools, including an increase in the opportunity for more school choice in the state. That's a win for everybody.
And so that was Speaker Voss speaking Wednesday on the Mark Belling Show. Superintendent Underly, what compromises would you be comfortable with?
So, you know, just from the comments, you know, a couple things. I know our elected officials care about all the kids in the state, and I will work with anyone and everyone to ensure, you know, that our schools and our kids are, you know, academically successful, you know, and they're safe. And I'm looking forward to having these conversations and working with our legislators and all Wisconsin's elected officials, because we all want the same things. You know, we want great schools, great teachers, beautiful and safe buildings, healthy and well-prepared kids. The issue is, it's kind of this all or nothing here. You know, the speaker mentioned, you know, expanding statewide school choice. That costs a lot of money, and really the choice for the choice for the parents and the kids in our state is their local public school. If we expand, you know, these private options, the taxpayers are funding that. It's not free. That has to come out of something, and it comes out of what they allocate for education in the state.
Let's go to Paula now in La Crosse. Paula, hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I just heard what Superintendent just said, and I feel very strongly that I don't want my tax dollars to go to private schools. Our previous governor obviously really promoted this, and I guess that is my question. Are our public schools suffering or not having the funds they need because of supporting these private schools? I mean, there is a separation of church and state, and I have a big problem with that, and I don't agree with it at all.
Paula, thanks for the call. Superintendent Underly, what would you say there to Paula's concerns?
I don't disagree with Paula. I'll just make it very clear. I don't feel that our tax dollars should be going to fund private schools either. However, the way that the system is set up currently, it is limited, as far as what money that we do have, going to voucher schools. And I would just like to hold the line on that. I don't see it going away. The Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, for example, had said that this is perfectly legal, what Wisconsin's doing. And even though I disagree with that, I would, certainly look to the taxpayers in the state to also put their foot down and just say, look, we don't want to expand this any further than it already is, because it is. It's a very expensive program. When you look at choice, and that does come out of, the allocation that the legislature puts for education in the state. They don't have a separate school voucher, for example, allocation. This was a program that was passed many years ago in a budget bill. It wasn't, never got a hearing, that kind of stuff. And so really the taxpayers of the state, the electors need to start speaking out and being much more vocal if they don't want to see it expand any further.
Speaking of budget, the Department of Public Instruction is requesting $2.5 billion from the next state budget, and this would increase per pupil funding other forms of aid to schools. Why is this needed?
So there's so many needs, right? I mean, we saw it before the pandemic, we certainly see it after. So a lot of this is actually to make up for the funding that is going to go away after the federal dollars run out in the 23-24 school year. So there's that. But then the other big pieces of it are reimbursement for special education aid. So right now, Wisconsin it's among the lowest, if we're not the lowest, when it comes to how much we reimburse our school districts for special education. And these are services all kids really use. You think about speech and language, and OT and PT and different things along those lines. But so school districts would be getting money to make those programs partially whole. So that's a big chunk of the, the request. And then the big piece of it also is a new program for mental health. Making sure that every school district gets a base amount for mental health, enough to fund at least a person, a social worker or a school counselor for their school district, in addition to what they already have. But we have to accept the fact that our kids in this state and everywhere in the nation, honestly, they need mental health care. And we have to bring the services to the schools because that's where the kids are. And so those are essentially the big three pieces of the budget. And it's meant to really start getting our school districts on a sustainable, predictable funding. Ultimately, it's going to take the work of the legislature and other elected leaders to get our school funding formula fixed so that our school districts don't have to keep going to referendum for these basic and much needed items.
Talking with State Schools Superintendent Jill Underly about last week's midterms and the future of education in Wisconsin, 800-642-1234 to join in. Steve in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, yes. If you look at the past 10 years, the amount of money we spend per pupil has gone up significantly higher than inflation. I also know of school districts and parents who filed open records requests, and they see nothing but left-wing propaganda coming from DPI. Perhaps if we focus more on what helps kids get ahead, reading and writing, arithmetic, we'd be better suited, and maybe our costs wouldn't be as high.
Superintendent Underly.
Yeah. So I suppose, when you look at what schools are spending their money on, it's personnel. I mean, it costs money to, educate our kids, teachers, education assistants, but all the support, individuals too, school counselors, custodians, food service, that is the bulk. And if you look at the costs have gone up over inflation, They have, because you kind of have to package all that together. And the legislature, you know, hasn't given us the inflation increase that they should be when they consider two-thirds funding. The amount that we spend on special education, that money comes out of programs that benefit all kids. And so we need to make sure that we make those programs whole so that our school districts aren't having to transfer money out of general education to fill those funding gaps too. I mean, schools are, you know, they are a basic necessity of democracy, and they cost money, and we have to maintain them, and we have to make sure that our kids are graduating well prepared, and it's not an inexpensive enterprise by any means.
The Department of Administration projected our state's ending balance at the end of the two-year budget cycle would be roughly $5 billion. Meanwhile, we saw school districts asking for over $2 billion through referendums. My guess is you'd encourage the state to use the surplus to overhaul the way schools are funded. What would you propose with the state surplus?
Well, the state surplus is tax dollars, right? And those tax dollars that we all paid in good faith, that our legislature would allocate to the programs that we care about. And so when you think about it at the end of the day, when the schools didn't get their increase from the legislature, there's part of that surplus right there. Part of that $6 billion came from the money that they did not allocate to schools in the past budget. So I would strongly encourage them to fix our school funding system, because right now they're abdicating that responsibility and they're placing the burden to fund this function of our society, the heart and soul of our communities, on the local taxpayers alone, really. By the time they, you know, completely dwindle the amount that they put towards our schools, I mean, our local taxpayers are shouldering the burden, as we see in the referendum. I mean, costs go up every year. Programs get weighed whether we cut them or not. And it all comes down to whether voters pass a referendum. And it shouldn't be that way, because our communities, our kids, our state deserves so much better.
Superintendent Underly, thank you for joining us.
Anytime, Kate. My pleasure.
Jill Underly is State Superintendent of Public Instruction. And if you missed any part of the State Capitol Report, you can visit our program page anytime and find hundreds of morning show programs in our archives. Visit WPR.org/mornings. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.